This is 4 a.m. my time. I just come back from China last night.
Oh, boy.
So I'm quite washed out, and I also have to switch my tongue from Chinese to English. So hopefully it will work. The main point I'm trying to make in this talk is that earthquakes in New Madrid seismic zone, like other intraplate earthquakes, is a quite a different beast. We have a lot of puzzle because partly of the reason is that this kind of beast is different from most of earthquakes we know that happens along plate boundaries. So they don't fit that kind of model. And they have a very different behavior, and that will affect our assessment of earthquake hazard in New Madrid and other intraplate settings. Okay? So, I will talk a little bit about New Madrid. Eric just talked a little bit of the puzzles. I'm going to show you a little bit more puzzles, okay? And from there, I will try to show you something we can learn from another intraplate setting. That's in North China. We have a big project that both Professor Sandoval and I are part of it. We are trying to study earthquakes in North China because earthquakes are more frequent, and we have a longer record, a history of earthquake record, and we may learn something useful there. And from there, I'm going to show you that the intraplate earthquakes in North China or in Central Eastern U.S. behave quite differently from most other earthquakes we know, such as in California. And from there, I will talk a little bit about what kind of impact that we have on our assessment of earthquake hazard. Okay, Eric already talked about this inelastic rebound theory. I want to touch upon that again because at the end, I'm going to show you that this model does not apply completely to intraplate settings, at least not in this way. It's more complicated. So basically, what we know about the cause of earthquakes is this inelastic rebound theory. So we have two blocks of crust rocks moving relative to each other, but on the fault zone, because the faults are generally very rough, so most of the time they are locked. The two other sides are trying to move, but the fault zones are locked, so that causes the bending of rocks. And until the stress reaches too high, some critical limit, then boom, this side will break and bounce back, like an inelastic plate or spring. So that's called an inelastic rebound. And when this happens, showing here as a fence, you will see the offset of the fence. This is caused by the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. Okay, so with this, you saw this picture, we understand why we have earthquakes along all these belts, because that's the boundary between tectonic plates. And what we know about tectonic plates are that the tectonic plates are constantly moving relative to each other all the time. And at least in the past 3 million years, the rate and the direction of the relative motion has not changed. Okay? So it's a very steady state. And remember that, because that condition won't apply to New Madrid. Okay? So with plate tectonic theory, we can explain, at least in theory, in concept, why we have earthquakes along the margins. But we also have problems with earthquakes such as New Madrid that happens right in the middle of tectonic plates where we are not supposed to have deformation or earthquakes. So the puzzles of New Madrid, I used to joke that the reason we have a lot of earthquakes in California and American Northwest is the price you have to pay for living in paradise. But we are in Midwest, right? Hot and humid and cold, and how come we also have to deal with earthquakes? Right in the middle of North American plate. Of course, we know what happened here. It's very famous because we had 3 or 4 earthquakes in the winter between 1811 and 1812. Not only that, since 1977, we set up the seismic network, and we have recorded now more than 5,000 small earthquakes. So it's going on all the time. Okay, and most of you know this story because, well, we also heard the historic writings that it's interesting, the myth of New Madrid earthquakes happened almost 200 years ago at the same time earthquake happened. And it continues, of course, this is Browning's very famous prediction of the New Madrid earthquake in 1990. And you can see that at that time, the little town of New Madrid was jammed by major news networks. Okay, and that myth continues, and there's a myth and a misconceptions. So part of my point is trying to understand better of some of these conceptions. Okay, so why we have earthquakes in New Madrid? You saw this picture that Eric shows. The old and general idea was that, well, because under the Mississippi embayment, we have ancient rift zones. What happened here was a scar in the crust. About 800 million years ago, the continent here was trying to split, okay? And this part was not complete, so it produced a scar there. And so it's weak. So conceptually, you think that because it's a scar, it's weak, you may have earthquakes there. And you saw this picture again, this figure. What I'm trying to show you here is that, look, not every scar has earthquakes. Okay? Of course, this is the New Madrid seismic zone, and the yellow lines outline this what we call ancient rift. Okay? So here, yes, the New Madrid seismic zone is in a rift zone. But the biggest rift zone in Central Eastern U.S. is actually this one, the Central American Central Continental Rift. Okay, this arm, as you can see, is clean. Geologically, it's a bigger rift. Okay, also you can see that not all the seismicities are in the rift zones, so it's not a sufficient condition. And you also saw this. Eric showed this, and we did some calculations. What I'm trying to show here is a stress. People are looking for, well, earthquakes happen maybe because it's weak or because stress is somehow concentrated. This is this figure Eric showed that shows the thickness of the lithosphere. And from that, we can calculate the stress distribution. And the red part are the higher stress. You can see some correlation. Seismicity here in the New Madrid area seems like red. But, well, again, it's not a perfect picture. Not all the red areas have earthquakes. And in some blue areas, we do have earthquakes also. Okay? So, more questions. Of course, Eric talked about this debate. That's the biggest debate right now in the scientific community. You can say it's coming because the paleo earthquake evidence. Oh, don't worry, be happy because of geology evidence. I'm going to show you again. Eric said it's important to repeat. Okay, so you saw this because of sand blow evidence, and all these sites are where we found sand blow evidence. And if you data them, and if the spatial distribution of sand blows found in this area is comparable to what the distribution we had in 1811, 1812, then we think maybe we had an earthquake as big as 1811, 1812. Okay? That is the foundation for us to think that maybe we have events that every 500 years, because look at this, all this age distribution seems cluster around 900 years, and their spatial distribution is similar to what we had 1811, 1812. So that's the evidence, or that's the reason we think that At that time, maybe we had an earthquake as big as 1811, 1812. But you saw this picture. If we have a magnitude 7 earthquake every 500 years, we are in a situation very similar to California. 700 earthquakes every few hundred years is what we see in California. But in California, the crust is moving, as Eric said, at 20 to 30 millimeters per year across the fault zone, okay? So we should see a comparable amount of fault slip. And we don't see that, okay? Some people think they saw it. So in the past 10 years, there's a lot of publications debate on this. But the general trend is that we see zero, okay? Let me show you this picture. This is a figure published by, this was made, not published, made by Professor Eric Clay of Purdue University. He plotted the published velocity of read across numerator fault zone with the year the paper published. You can see the trend. We are going down. And he was joking that he knows what kind of paper he's going to write 2 years in the future. And this debate is very, very hot debate. So every time a lot of these papers are published in Nature or Science, the crown jewels of scientific journals. Okay? So, but the general trend is that we are seeing nothing. Okay? So that is one question, one major question we have to face. You know, if we have these earthquakes, how come we don't see that? Okay? Because we are not seeing that, so one of my colleagues, Professor Seth Stan from Northwestern, was thinking that maybe this sequence of earthquakes in New Madrid area is coming to an end. Okay? But they say, well, we do have seismicities. We have all these small earthquakes. Are they telling us something? Well, generally we see earthquakes, we think that small earthquakes, the general interpretation is that they are the signs of stress and buildup. But there is another possibility that they are maybe just aftershocks. When we first proposed this idea, people say, are you crazy? It's 200 years after. How can you have aftershocks that long? Because most aftershocks last for a few years, no more than 10 years, which is true for interplate earthquakes. The earthquakes happen along plate boundaries, such as those in California. For example, this one shows the Norman Prita earthquake along San Andreas Fault, and it decays in a few years. Okay, but be careful that this horizontal, the time scale is different. Okay, this is 5 years, 5 years, but here is 10 years, 10 years. In Northwest, American Northwest, we have good evidence that earthquakes can aftershock sequences can last for 50 years or even longer. The trend here, the bottom figure is New Madrid, and that's another different time scales here. That's 50 years each bar here. So the general trend looks like an aftershock trend. It's a decaying trend, okay? And we don't know exactly if this is aftershocks, but I can tell you quite confidently that aftershocks can last more than 10 years. One good evidence comes from China. This is the Tangshan earthquake. I don't know if you remember the Tangshan earthquake. That's in 1976. That earthquake killed 250,000 people. Okay, it totally wiped out industrial city Tangshan, just 200 miles east of Beijing, the capital. Okay, what's good about this data is that the digital earthquake record in China started in 1970. So we have a few years recording before the major earthquake. So we have something to compare with. And you can see the trend, okay? The trend since then, more than, almost 40 years now, is much higher than the background before the earthquake. So in other words, aftershock continues. I just learned that I learned a few days ago in China that this paper that Seth Stein and I published 2 years ago actually saved, helped CEA, the director of CEA, China Earthquake Administration, because last year there was a 4.1 earthquake in Tangshan. Okay, so the central government was jittered. And the premier of China was asking the director of China Earthquake Administration what's going on there. And his reply was that was an aftershock. And the premier, who was trained as a geologist, and other people had questions about that, say, how can aftershocks happen 40 years after the earthquake? So they have to find evidence. And they were searching online, they found this paper. So that'll perhaps save the director's job. And we have also theoretical background to explain why we may have long sequences of aftershocks. In one theory, the aftershock sequences is a function of the loading rate. So for the California earthquakes or other interplate earthquakes, the aftershock is a few years, 10 years. But in the New Madrid seismic zone or other intraplate settings, because of the very low loading rate, we may have very long aftershock sequences. Okay, so the implication will be very different if the small earthquakes we see today are not signs of a stress and build up, but aftershocks. Okay, and another thing I want to show you is, well, that's actually the first study I did to get into the New Madrid seismic zone. I came here in 1992, but for a long time, I kind of stayed away from New Madrid earthquakes because it's a very controversial topic. But, you know, my students somehow get into this. What we are studying here was the impact of 1811, 1812 earthquakes. With all the controversies surrounding New Madrid earthquake zones, only one thing I would say is nobody argues. That is, three or maybe four major earthquakes happened in 1812. So I was talking with my student. I say, this is for sure. Let's see what kind of impact, stress impact, those earthquakes may have in this area. Okay. So this is a numerical simulations. We're showing the stress change. The blues are a stress change right after the earthquake. So the blue you see is the stress drop along the fault zones. Okay. Once earthquake happens, stress drop. At the same time, in the tips, around it, you will see some increase of stress. The red one here, so this is 1843, 1895. What you see here is that, well, this is today, okay? So 2 points. One is that 200 years after the earthquake, the New Madrid seismic zone is still blue. It's not enough time for stress to restore back to the fault zone because the loading rate is very low. Another point is that in the past 200 years, in the area, not within the fault zone, but on the tip and in the surrounding areas, those are the dots, we had about a dozen middle-sized earthquakes, magnitude 5 to 6. Those earthquakes mostly happen in regions where the stress seems increased because of the 1811, 1812 earthquake. We also did an energy calculation. Okay? Because of that earthquake, it caused regional perturbation of the stress. And so this figure shows the strain energy that migrated from the New Madrid fault zone. Okay? So those are the strain energy produced by 1811, 1812 earthquakes. And since then, we had about, as I said, about a dozen middle-sized earthquakes that release energy. So if you subtract this energy, okay, this is a residual energy there. Not all this energy will be used for earthquakes. Maybe just a tiny fraction, which we don't know how much. But if 10% of this energy can be used to produce earthquakes, we can still have a number of magnitude 6 earthquakes in this part or in eastern Arkansas. In this sense, we can still call those earthquakes since well, in the past 100 years, or aftershocks, because they inherited the strain energy released from 1811, 1812 earthquakes. Okay. Another puzzle that Professor Sandoval touched upon but did not expand, that is, another thing about this earthquake is that they are not there all the time, not like the California earthquakes. All the evidence indicated that this sequence of earthquakes happened a few thousand years ago, perhaps no more than 10,000 years ago. Okay. It's somehow, well, it's a transient phenomenon. And if it's a transient phenomenon physically, it has a starting point, it has an ending point. Somehow it started. We don't know how it started. The most popular theory says that it has to do perhaps with the last retreating of North American glaciers. The retreating of the glaciers perturbed regional stress field that perhaps triggered these events. The most attractive point of this theory or hypothesis is the timing, because that's about the same time the New Madrid earthquake sequence seems to started, okay? But if it started, it has to end. We don't know when it's ending. That's another debate. Because the loading rate, the tectonic loading rate, which we can measure using GPS, as Professor Sandoval appointed to, we know that the strain rate or the loading rate is very, very slow. So it cannot produce a magnitude 7 earthquake every 500 years forever, okay? It's like you look at somebody's paycheck. If it's $1,000 a month, he cannot buy a new car every month, okay? He cannot buy a new house every year. If he's doing that in the past few years, you wonder, maybe the guy has inherited money from his dad, right? So that's how he can have all these big spendings. But if he inherited money from his dad, then you can ask, you know, with this kind of spending, when he's going to broke? He can't go that forever. Okay, so that's another argument there. A lot of these puzzles we have, it has to do with the model of earthquakes that we have. We started with the model of inelastic rebound theory. We are assuming that across the fault zones, we have constant loading, a constant motion across the fault zones, which applies to San Andreas fault, sorry. I thought coffee may help, but does not help completely, okay? But we don't have that here in New Madrid. And because the history is so short, it's really hard to see a pattern, okay? So I remember one day I was wondering in my office, I said, where can I see a better evidence of intraplate earthquakes in other parts of the world? Because I have a map of China there. I said, maybe I should go back, just look at my home country. Okay, so what's different about North China? I'm going to talk about what we can learn from North China. North China is also in the middle of a plate, the Eurasian plate, thousands of miles away from plate boundaries. But for some reasons, one is that our ancestors, the Chinese, are very serious about earthquakes. Whenever there is a big earthquake, there is a government official, his job is recording faithfully all the unusual natural phenomena. And because of that, the historic earthquake record in China goes back to about 3,000 years, the best record in the history, in the world, okay? And so that's good. That gives us more evidence or more record to look at. Another reason is that North China has more frequent earthquakes. The strain rate there is order of magnitude higher than Central Eastern U.S., so we have more things to look at, okay? So let's look at it. And I'm going to focus on northern China, and although we have more than 2,000 years of record, the best record is in the past 700 years. So I'm going to start, look at the 700 years record, only looking at the big earthquakes. Let's start from this one. 1303 Hongdong earthquake, magnitude 8. Okay? Now, if you live in that time in China and you were a geologist, you say, aha, no surprise. Because this earthquake happens in a fault zone, a rift zone, like the New Madrid rift zone. Okay? It's a weak place in the crust. 200 years later, we had another big earthquake, 1556 Huaxin earthquake, magnitude 8.3. This is the deadliest earthquake in human history. 830,000 people killed. 830,000 people were killed in this earthquake. Again, by that time, okay, you look at the history, you're a geologist, you say, I have a perfect theory. Earthquake happens in rift zones because this is part, this is called the Weihe Rift Zone, but structurally connected with Shanxi Rift Zones. You would say rift zones is a host of major earthquakes in intraplate setting, okay? Just after you publish your paper. The biggest earthquake in China ever recorded happened here, thousands of miles east of the rift zones, right here, 8.5. Now you struggle. You are a geologist. You are capable of finding some evidence to support your theory. You find, aha, I still have a theory because this is a fault zone. It's called a Tanlu Fault. It's a major fault in eastern China. The problem is that this fault zone was active in the Mesozoic 130 million years ago. Okay, in the past few tens of million years, this fault zone is not moving at all. Today, if you look at the GPS, the rate of relative motion is almost zero, like New Madrid. Okay, and then 90 years later, we have another earthquake that jumped over here, north of Beijing, in a place that we did not even know there is a fault zone. Then in the past century, we had three major earthquakes in North China. The 1966 earthquake is a group of five earthquakes, magnitude 7.8, the biggest one. This was the earthquake that initiated the modern research of earthquakes in China. And actually, the China Earthquake Administration was established after this earthquake. And their official mandate by the government was to predict earthquakes. Okay? After the earthquake, the government wanted to predict earthquakes. And the point I'm trying to make in this figure is that the three major earthquakes, of course, I should mention here. Okay, Tangshan earthquake, just mentioned. Quarter million people were killed. And Haicheng earthquake, also very famous because, according to some, this was the first successful prediction of earthquakes. Okay? But I'm not going to talk about earthquake prediction today, another very fascinating topic. Maybe we have another chance. But the point I'm trying to make here is that these three major earthquakes all happened in unexpected places. They happened in places that before the earthquake, we did not know that they were major fault zones, active fault zones. It's a surprise, okay? And there's a lot of surprise if you look back. You look at all these earthquakes in China, and one thing that you realize is that for all the major earthquakes, magnitude 7 or above, in the past 2,000 years, not a single one repeated on the same fault segment. Okay? Now, think about it. If you are betting your money based on what happened previously, your chance of winning is zero. Every time you lose, every time an earthquake happens, it's a big surprise. Well, if all the earthquakes is randomly jumping around, then as an earthquake scientist, we might as well fold our tent and go home. But it's not that pessimistic, okay? Because if you look at the, what this figure shows is the magnitude and time events. So this shows the earthquake in the Shaanxi Rift, in the Weihe Rift. Okay, you will see that there's on top of this figure is the energy released by these earthquakes. And the yellow, the blues are this part of the rift, and the red is from this rift. You will see that they have some complementary features. While one fault zone is heavy, releasing a lot of energy, another fault zone is relatively quiet. Okay, so what this says is that these two fault zones are not completely isolated. They actually talk with each other. And the same thing is true if you along these two rift zones together and compare with earthquakes in the rest part of North China Plain, they also have these complementary features. Okay? This indicated that those fault zones are not isolated. They behave as part of a complex system. And that leads us to what I'm going to try to make here, is that we need a new model for intraplate earthquakes. That model is fundamentally different from the model we are used to based on interplate earthquakes. Well, first look at interplate earthquakes, those along plate boundaries. Okay, so this is a two plate moving relative to each other, and this is a boundary fault. Across the boundary fault, the plate motion is a steady state. Okay, the loading is constant. So spatial temporary pattern is somehow, well, I don't want to say predictable, but can be anticipated. First, that most earthquakes will happen along the boundary zone, no surprise. Second is that because the loading rate is constant, and because earthquake is releasing this input energy, so somehow some kind of periodical behavior can be anticipated. Okay, they have to release the amount of energy. But the situation is quite different if we look at what happens in an intraplate setting. Okay, in intraplate, in a plate interior, we have many fault zones. Collectively, they are accommodating the tectonic loading from the far field. Across any of the fault zones, we don't have a theoretical or physical reason to say that the loading is constant. Okay, because across the fault zone here is a block of rocks in the same plate. They are not tectonic, they are not different tectonic plates. They are not moving at a constant rate. If they are not moving at a constant rate, we don't have a reason to think that the energy input is constant, and therefore they have a constant rate of energy release. Okay, so what happens here then is that conceptually we can think that if an earthquake happens along the one fault zone, broke one fault zone, then this one will fall, the stress will be released, and it will fall into a dormant for a long time. At the same time, the regional stress field will be changed. So next time maybe this guy, and next time maybe this guy. And if we are following earthquakes by looking for where we had earthquakes before, we are missing the chance. Okay, we are missing the target. Every time we think, oh, we have an earthquake here, and then we're going to throw all our money and our instrument here, next time we'll be surprised. And that seems what's happening in China. Okay? And so the basic physics here is we have a system of faults that are interacting with each other. And that is the cause of the complexity of intraplate earthquakes. How faults interact with each other is a very complicated topic. We don't know yet. Okay? And so we did some study where I'm going to show you one aspect of this complexity. Okay? So we did a very simple study. We have a plate. We load from the sides, and we give some initial perturbation of the stress, and we will look at the the failure of the each cell. Okay, if one cell fails, we said it's an earthquake. At the same time, it will perturb stress field in the surrounding regions. And so, just look at this figure first. Okay, this is the plate. Each dot is a simulated earthquake, if you want to call that. It's a failure of that cell. Okay, the color coding is simply relative time in this numerical experiment. Okay, so if I run this model for 300 years, I see earthquakes are scattered everywhere, randomly. Okay. Now, if I continue this experiment for 3,000 years, you say, aha, I see a pattern. Seismic zones, bells, okay? And now you continue. This one is for 30,000 years. After 30,000 years, you see earthquake everywhere. My point here, this is not a really earthquake simulation, it's too simple, okay? But my point here is that the so-called spatial temporal patterns of earthquakes that we use, I'm going to talk about in the last part, and we rely on to establish some patterns of earthquakes are critically based on the type of data we have, especially the length, the size of the time window we have. If we have only 300 years record, we see this pattern. If we have a 3,000 years record, we see this pattern. Okay? In North America, we have only about 200 to 300 years historical record. Do we see the whole elephant, or we just touch one leg of the elephant and think that the elephant is a big paw? Okay? So this kind of complexity will affect our earthquake assessment, hazard assessment. I will start, I will illustrate this point by using the Wenchuan earthquake. Okay. I'm sure that some of you remember this earthquake in 2008 that happened in Sichuan province, by the way, my hometown. And 90,000 people were killed. This earthquake became very personally connected and emotional to me because at the time, I had two students, both come from this region. Okay. And after this earthquake, well, there's some pictures of the earthquake. It's a total destruction in many towns. I was there less than a month after the earthquake. Here is me standing by a collapsed building. And after the earthquake, following the earthquake, the Chinese internet was flooded by angry criticism of the government, the corrupted government officials and constructors, okay? Because a lot of buildings, especially school, collapsed. A lot of kids or children were killed, okay? People were very angry. So the first thing I looked at was hazard map, because earthquake hazard map is the foundation for building code. So I'm pretty sure that we have a lot of corrupted government officials. I'm pretty sure that we have very bad constructors. But we first have to look at what kind of requirement that they have to follow by building their buildings, okay? So here is the epicenter. And this map here, without going into too much details, is the hazard, is the prediction of the risk of ground acceleration. So the red ones are very dangerous, and yellow and the green ones are relatively low risk, okay? And this zone here is the ruptured Longmenshan fault zone. It's yellow and green, which that means don't worry, okay? When I first saw this one, the Chinese hazard map, I said, well, this must be wrong. So I went to USGS website. This, by the way, is a USGS hazard map. Okay. So you ask, how come we get this wrong? Well, actually, the reason is simple. Okay. Look here. We have this red belt because this is what we call the Xianshuihe Fault. It had a lot of earthquakes in the past 200 years. We have a red dot here Because here in 1933, we had a magnitude of 7.3 earthquake. And we have a low risk zone here until 2008 Wenchuan earthquake, because here before the earthquake, we had a very limited seismicity in the past 200 years. Okay? So we missed it because here we have our basic assumptions. We are assuming that the past large earthquakes will indicate where the future large earthquakes will happen. And we are using the seismicity as an indicator of stress and buildup. Okay? And the same kind of thinking is working here. Of course, here we had large earthquakes in the past. We had a lot of seismicities here. And that's why USGS is put a bullseye here. Okay? There are a lot of things going on there. It's a very difficult job. I'm not going to criticize USGS, but this is a very, very difficult job. Okay? This kind of hazard map mapping is based on some fundamental theory that is based on interplate earthquakes, such as the repeated earthquake, the recurrence interval. Now, the very concept is questionable, and it's being debated in the scientific community. And also, there's a lot of parameters can go there into this model that is pretty constrained. I'm not going to go into too much details, just to show you two maps here, okay? And these are two different hazard assessments. And the top figures assuming 10% probability of earthquakes in the next 50 years. Okay, so in a very simplistic way, it's basically assuming having an earthquake in 500 years. Okay, and you can calculate in the next 500 years what's the largest earthquake you're going to have, and from that earthquake, you can calculate the peak or the peak ground acceleration. Okay, the major shaking there. And that put us in danger, but not that dangerous. But in 2002, USGS released another map. This now is based on 2% of probability. Without much thinking, we are able to see that our rate of risk is, our level of risk is as high as California. Because here we are assuming, we are looking at a time window of 2,500 years. And the theory basically goes there that in 2,500 years, we are bound to have a big earthquake, like in 1811, 1812. And you put that in a higher end of the estimated magnitude, you're going to have a very dangerous situation there. Okay? So these are subtle numbers in the assessment, but it can have very different consequences. I'm not going to... I don't have time, I don't have expertise to get into too much of this. But generally, when I talk with people, people say, what's wrong to be more conservative? It's good that we build a strong building, so just in case an earthquake happens, we won't have casualties. Well, the problem is that we have a limited amount of money and resources. Okay? One example was a few years ago in Memphis, the Veterans Hospital needed to retrofit. And according to the new rule, they have to spend $40 million to have a building that follows this requirement. So the question becomes, how to spend that money? Do you spend the money on patient, nurse, or you spend on concrete? Okay, so complicated issues. Just to show you, this is another slide, okay? Just to show you how challenging this is, we know that last year we had a big earthquake in Japan. Okay, this earthquake, Tohoku earthquake, was again a total surprise, and scientists totally missed it because our theory, without going into too much details, our existing theory says that in this part of the region we won't have big earthquakes. The subducting plate is too old. The coupling is going to be too weak to produce this week, so we missed here. And this hazard map, by the way, was made by the Japanese government about 15 years ago. And so one of my colleagues, Bob Ganner, published a paper last year to show that in the past 10 years, All the earthquakes in Japan that has more than 10 casualties. Okay, so each of the dots here. Look at this. Okay, most of the sites happens in regions that the government think is low risk. So the same type of thinking or reasoning missed again and again. Okay, I'm not blaming anyone, just saying that our current theory is not perfect. Okay, we need to realize that. And as the last slide, my co-author and a colleague and sometimes a very controversial figure, Professor Seth Stern, sent me this quote. Okay, his father was a professor. His father is a professor of economics. So he's reading a lot of economics books, and you can read this part. Okay. So Kenneth Arrow was serving in the army or in the navy, was helping making weather predictions for long-term predictions. And they know it's hard, and the forecasters were convinced and requested that the forecast be discontinued. Here. The commanding general is well aware of the forecasts are no good. However, he needs them for planning purpose. We need that for planning purpose. Thank you.